from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. The teaching of foreign languages and the presence of religion and the humanities in American education. Two conversations this week on Soundings. My guests are Rosemary Fayal of the University of Rochester, Joan Hind Stewart of North Carolina State University, Ronald Sharp of Kenyon College, and Warren Nord of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. First, a discussion with Rosemary Fayal and Joan Stewart about the teaching of foreign language and literature. Following that, a conversation with Ronald Sharp and Warren Nord about religion and the humanities in American education. Joan Stewart and Rosemary Fayal, welcome to Soundings. We're going to talk about foreign languages and the teaching of foreign languages. Are some kids just gifted at learning foreign languages and other kids are not? Rosemary?
Well, for example, precisely in the study of how languages are learned and acquired, we learn how people learn. Mm-hmm. And in so doing, we may then take some of these strategies and use a wide variety of them in the classroom. So, for example, a student who seems to have this sort of gift, what you've called a gifted ability, we may often find that that is an acute ability to mimic and repeat what is heard, or often to suspend one's own patterns of speech. Mm-hmm. And to easily, as much as an actor, what we call a gifted actor, an inborn actor can do. Right. So in studying these strategies, we can then use a wide variety. I don't think any teacher these days takes one approach and applies it. We know how students learn in different ways, and we can accommodate our methodology. So, for example, the slower learner will devise strategies that are quite different from those we may use with what we are calling now the gifted learner.
Mm-hmm. Joan Stewart, just a sort of a footnote here, as we're talking about the teaching of foreign languages. What about the use of English in the classroom? When you go in to teach French, Rosemary, when you go in to teach Spanish, do you speak in French or in English? How does that mixture work?
We do it as much as we possibly can in the foreign language, but I think that there's been a development in our thinking on that score. During the heyday of the audiolingual method, we felt as though we could not utter a syllable of English in the foreign language. Somehow we would compromise the entire enterprise if we did that. And we no longer feel that way. We use a lot of posters, a lot of tapes, a lot of videos, a lot of aids to teaching the foreign language, which help to keep things in the target language. But we also feel more relaxed about it. We feel that if the moment comes when it's better to give the student the equivalent word in English, we do so.
Uh-huh. How's business these days? Do you have to go out and drum it up, Joan Stewart? You run the one of the foreign language departments at North Carolina State University. Do you have to go out and advertise your courses, or do the kids come in and sign up on their own volition?
Business is very good. There's been a sizable growth in the number of students taking foreign languages at universities and colleges all over the United States. And there's been some change as well in the languages which they're taking. Spanish mm-hmm. remains the favorite language. Probably nearly half of all students enrolled in language courses in the United States.
Is that because
Spanish.
It's relatively easy, or is it because we have a dominant a language on the rise, as it were? Rosemary, help you comment on that?
I think principally the number of Hispanics in the United States has influenced that. It has a stereotypic image as being easy, but certainly we know that the patterns of Romance languages are similar, and perhaps phonetically there's some ease to it.
Mm-hmm. You have any sense of this with respect to the high schools, Joan? We were talking about college kids. What goes on there? What kinds of kids do you get when you teach them here at the college level?
We get all kinds of kids. I think we're more and more getting kids who want to study languages because they're persuaded that they will help them in their professional lives, because mm-hmm. they'll help them get jobs. We're also getting kids who are influenced directly or indirectly by the new emphasis on cultural literacy and basic education, back to the basics kind of things, and foreign languages is perceived as a part of that education. And again, I think that Spanish is the predominant language there. But one of the interesting things that's happening is that we're getting more and more people who are interested in learning Chinese and Japanese, and those languages have increased dramatically in the past few years. At North Carolina State University, we're beginning a regular instructional program in fall in Swahili and one in Chinese, and we've never had them before. We have a Japanese program that's several years old, which has done very, very well. the predominant languages remain Spanish, French, German, Russian, and Italian. Mm-hmm. But these others are growing in importance.
Let's talk about foreign languages and foreign language instruction in the context of some very large cultural issues, which is to say the stereotype of America as the policeman, the big bully in the world, the relationship of the United States to what we call the third world. How does the learning, the teaching of foreign languages, how do they fit into that picture? Are they going to help us to be better world citizens? Presumably, that's what you're after in a cosmic sense. Reduce that to some particularities for me, Rosemary Fayal.
In my own work, I take a subversive role. I set out to show students very clearly through a linguistic medium at first, and then later perhaps through readings in the language, what it looks like from the other side of the Rio Grande or the cultural barrier. And we use authentic materials from countries where, for example, Spanish is spoken, so that students can see what a typical Mexicano thinks of a gringo. Mm-hmm. How America's actions in the past have influenced the lives of Spanish-speaking people, how the presence of America in those countries bears down on daily life, political life, and...
What do you mean specifically? Were you talking about recipes, movies, pop culture? What is it that you use to present this other side of the picture?
All of those certainly would be appropriate. To give you an example, in an elementary class, I'll bring in advertisements that are directly translated from the English, often with horrifying mistakes, starting with the Parker pen that avoids embarazos, pregnancies, and a few of the other classics. I'll bring in taped advertisements that directly say, Pampers es el mejor diaper para su hijo, with all the anglicisms, well, they'll say pañal, but all the anglicisms in there to show what it would be like to be sitting in a Mexican home and being bombarded by a succession of American-based commercials. Just to give you one example, that would be at a more elementary level. At a more advanced level, I would take newspaper articles that discuss the same events, what is it in Cuba? Come on, help me here. The Bay of Pigs, and we say the Playa de Girón in Spanish. It's not even called the Bay of Pigs. So we might take some of Fidel Castro's speeches on the Playa de Girón and compare it with some of the Kennedy documents on the Bay of Pigs to give you an example of specific things you can do within the linguistic medium. And it's amazing how minds are opened and sometimes changed, but certainly subverted.
Joan, Stuart?
The word that we use a lot nowadays, the expression we use a lot nowadays to describe what we're teaching for, what we're aiming at, is communicative competence. And this is the buzzword that has succeeded the method that Rosemary described a few minutes ago, the audiolingual method, which had its heyday a few decades ago. Our effort now is to teach students languages in such a way that there's room for creativity, that there's a lot of flexibility built in, so that they don't just memorize set patterns, but that they can function properly in different situations. You know, the teaching of reading may be what's changed in some ways most dramatically. In the old days, the way you taught reading was to give the students a text and to tell them to go home and read it and come back the next day and tell you what it said. And I remember going home at night with a text in French and sitting down with a dictionary at my elbow and starting to proceed through it one word by one word and looking up each word as I went along, and I'd write it in the text over the word in French. And it was a monstrous task. I felt as though I was wrestling with a beast. There were certainly some good came out of it, certainly. But we do that very differently now. We have much more of a sense that reading should be integrated into everything else we're doing, that we begin teaching reading by setting a context for the passage. We situate the passage. We tell the students what it's about. We brainstorm about it. And then we teach them to look for the broad lines, much in the same way that if we were reading a newspaper article or a poem or any kind of short passage, we as native speakers of a language would look for the broad lines of development.
Joan Stuart and Rosemary Fayal, we're talking about foreign languages and the teaching of foreign languages. Let's talk about some of the issues in the academy itself, the literature of other countries. What's going on of interest to scholars? Why should the public know about these things, critical, theoretical issues that you professors of foreign languages are looking at these days? Rosemary?
Well, in the same way that we've been talking about ways in which language teaching have evolved. And those who studied languages years ago will perhaps be interested in how it's different. I think the teaching of literature in the past few decades has also evolved tremendously, so that to enter a literature classroom, be it a foreign language literature classroom or an English language literature, the teaching methodologies, the pedagogical implications of theory have also in turn evolved, perhaps very complexly, in a way that would be very reductionist if we tried perhaps to simplify them here. But it's important for the public, I think, to know that in the same way that language is not taught in a parroting fashion, literature, for the most part, and this gets me into a lot of hot water to even say it, in general, no longer does the professor profess to have the keys of interpretation and know the authorial intent and communicate to that ignorant student what the author meant.
Right.
That's general and that's reductionist. But I think that same pattern of opening up critically and in some cases closing down critically has also happened in literature.
What would you say, Rosemary Fayall Jones-Stewart, to the charge that the teaching of foreign languages, like the teaching of American and English literature, has become so theoretical that nobody knows what's going on, that the professor walks in and says, I can't really help you to understand what's going on in this passage? Certainly we're not at a stage as bad as that, are we, Joan?
We've been accused in the academy of developing approaches to the study and the teaching of literature which are isolationist. This is a word that I've heard used. It occurs to me that some of the approaches we've developed are remarkably integrationist. I think specifically of feminism. Of all literary movements, feminism has probably most touched the lives of individuals, has been most connected to what's happening in the economy, the entrance of the woman into the workforce, the evolution of the two-career family. And we see the connections when we read literature and we talk about it in feminist terms with what's happening in the real world. We begin to understand that literature is about can be about process and about self-criticism, that it's not necessarily fixed, that it's contextual, it's relational, and I think that's what women's studies are all about. So that I think frequently our critics are not paying real attention to what's happening. I think people feel pressured by things they don't understand and tend to reject them.
Let's conclude our conversation, Rosemary Fayall, Joan Stewart. What message or notion or idea would you leave with a general audience about the teaching of foreign languages today? Why are you passionate about this? Why does it matter to you? Why do you think it should matter to other people? Rosemary?
I'm passionate about it because I think finally I've learned one of the reasons why I love language teaching so much. It's a lot of fun. And students have a lot of fun doing it. And I've gotten to the point where I can change their classroom expectations within a matter of minutes after they're in the classroom. The normal college curriculum presents them with a lot of reading and lectures. And the foreign language classroom is so totally different than those experiences I just mentioned. So for me, one of the wonderful things about language teaching is putting the students in another frame of mind and mode and having them have a lot of fun. We have a lot of fun in my foreign language classroom. And that doesn't mean that we're not learning and that we're not getting access to culture. We certainly are. Often they're not aware that we're doing it in your normal patterns of learning. In other words, the whole nature of studying and speaking, reading a foreign language is so different than anything else. And I make it a lot of fun, and the students have fun doing it. That makes me passionate about teaching it.
Rosemary Fayall teaches at the University of Rochester. Joan Hind Stewart is a professor of French and head of the Department of Foreign Languages and Literature at North Carolina State University. She also chairs the North Carolina Humanities Council. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on American Education continues. The topic now is Religion and the Humanities in the American Classroom. My guests are Ronald Sharp of Kenyon College and Warren Nord of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Ronald Sharp is a member of the Advisory Group on Primary and Secondary Education at the National Endowment for the Humanities. Here is Warren Nord.
Well, I'm writing a book on religion and morality and education, but the book is prompted in part by a conversation which is going on in our culture now, which has become very prominent, as a matter of fact, within the last year or year and a half. I suppose the thing that's prompted this conversation is a series of court cases having to do with the role of religion in public education. The Mozart case in Tennessee having to do with reading books that a group of conservative religious folks objected to. Mm-hmm. The decision in Alabama about secular humanism in textbooks, and then the decision of the Supreme Court on creationism and evolution. There are a lot of folks, mostly conservative religious folks, who are upset about the absence of religion or the way religion is treated in textbooks and in public education. And all of this got me to thinking about whether or not there might be some kind of a case to be made.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a difference between talking about the history of religion and talking about proselyting. That seems to be a fairly simple distinction.
Perhaps. Yeah, and it's one the Supreme Court has made very clear. The court has said that you can't try to make students religious, you can't try and convert them. Uh-huh. But on the other hand, you can teach about religion. And as a matter of fact, several Supreme Court justices have been eloquent in their claims that religion is central to an understanding of Western civilization.
Mm-hmm. Ron Sharp, you have some stories to tell about this sort of absence and presence in the humanistic, the humanities element in primary and secondary education.
My stories come from the same place, I think, that Warren's do. But I think this is part of a larger problem that relates to the controversy about religion in the textbooks, and that is that publishers of textbooks seem to be so anxious to avoid controversy, to avoid offending any particular group, that what often gets left out is content of any kind. It's not just the fault of textbook publishers. I think there are at least two factors at work. One is this terror on the part of textbook publishers to offend anybody. There are so many groups out there with quite legitimate claims. Certainly we want to live in a culture in which people are not offended, in which everybody tolerates various points of views. But when this starts getting translated into practices on the part of publishers of tiptoeing around, desperately trying to avoid something, what you often end up with is deadly prose, which is attempting to walk on eggshells, not mm-hmm. to offend anybody, and a kind of absence of content altogether. So that's one factor. And the other factor, I think, is has to do with a larger direction in American education over the last half century, and that is an increasing emphasis on skills as opposed to content. And naturally, this distinction can't be made in any absolute way. There's clearly a relationship, and an important one, between the two. But I think the pendulum has swung rather dramatically in recent years towards skills rather than content. But often these kinds of tasks are done at the expense of learning, for example, when the Civil War was. In literature, you have something like the same thing. People are taught how to read. They're taught all kinds of elaborate literary terminology, which again is important and again is necessary, but often at the expense of actually reading books. Mm-hmm. And so a number of people who have been active in the educational reform movement in recent years have been saying, in a way that seems to me to be justified, that we really need to start putting a lot more emphasis on content again. Every culture has a way of passing this knowledge on. In modern industrial societies, it's done through an educational system. And when you get to the point where we seem to be now in America, that the body of shared knowledge is not shared, or is not shared very widely, mm-hmm. Then it doesn't seem to me to become alarmist to say that, in fact, the glue of the culture may be coming apart.
No, we got a problem. Warren, Nord?
I think what we're getting at here is something very important about the way in which we conceive of liberal education. For a long time, liberal education was conceived of as a kind of initiation into one's culture. The opponent of liberalization was the person who insisted on specialization. A liberal education was to provide one with a broad understanding, a broad cultural literacy. There's certainly the danger that cultural literacy will be defined by a particular group and not be representative of the true history of a culture and the various peoples and ideas which make it up. Nowadays, I think the more common notion of liberal education is one in which to have a liberal education is to have a kind of open education. The emphasis is on openness, not on the shared body of knowledge, so that we get the cafeteria selection of courses, the shopping mall high school.
Openness to the point of letting one's brains fall out, where we there are no standards.
Well, yeah, probably in a few cases. And of course, this ties back to the idea of whether or not you can have skills without content. For example, in undergraduate colleges, oftentimes what you have are distribution requirements. Three science courses, three social science courses, three humanities courses, and who cares what they are?
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to have any kind of broad knowledge of Western civilization. You might take a course on the history of the Netherlands in the 17th century, and that's fine. That's what you need to have some kind of historical understanding. But there's no central core of knowledge which we think everybody has to have, in part because we're worried about requiring some kind of elitist education of students. But in part, I think the problem is much deeper. It goes to the fact that no longer do we have much confidence that we can define what's important for everyone to know.
Mm-hmm.
This is the kind of case, I suppose, that Alan Bloom makes in his book, also on the bestseller list, The Closing of the American Mind. We have a kind of a vicious cultural relativism. The pluralism degenerates into a relativism because we don't have the sense anymore that we can define what is important for everyone to know, that there are certain things which constitute good education and others which are bad education.
Ron Sharp had a comment.
Well, I think this point that Warren is making about the loss of confidence in making judgments about what constitutes important material to study in an education is crucial. One dimension of this problem that a number of us on the NEH panel became concerned with is the lack of serious important writers in elementary school textbooks. It was astonishing to a number of us to discover that the reading books that fourth, fifth, sixth graders use in most grade schools throughout the country contain selections of literature which are really, for the most part, not very good. One of the shocking discoveries that we made was that in most of the books used in fourth grade, to take one example, 95% of the literature is contemporary and only 5% classic. And by classic, I mean work written by writers that are generally considered to be important writers. 3% of the literature in these books is poetry, 97% prose. Now, if you compare this to the analogous books even 30 years ago, the figures are very, very different. About half of the material in these books used to be poetry and half prose, now down to 3% poetry. And about half of the material used to be by classic writers. There seems to be a new orthodoxy which says, in effect, that children can't understand writing by so-called major writers. That
tough stuff.
Almost by definition, it's too hard for them.
Yeah.
There are rather mindless readability formulas applied in the world of textbooks in which publishers count up the number of syllables per word, the number of words per sentence, the number of sentences per paragraph, and through an elaborate quantitative formula decide whether or not a fourth grader can read this book without letting anybody make an independent judgment.
And I take it that the same situation obtains when you talk about the presence of religion in the textbooks. It isn't that you would be naming Shakespeare or, well, I mean, would it be specific for me, Warren, or Martin Luther, for example? Or
yes, there are history books, textbooks of Western civilization
that
which
don't
mention the Reformation.
Unbelievable.
Even the standard treatment in most books of important religious figures is minimal. So, for example, the average world history textbook of, say, this is a high school book now, of, say, 600 or 800 pages will give 2 pages to the history of the Hebrews and maybe 2 pages to the history of Christianity, the first 1,000 years of Christianity. Jesus, on average, gets about 4 paragraphs, less in one history textbook I noted than Eleanor of Aquitaine.
Goodness gracious.
After 1800, religion virtually disappears from the textbooks, and there's really nothing. There's a sense in which public education initiates students into a very secular world. Mm-hmm. Just because religion is absent, Bloom says in The Closing of the American Mind that it's not a tyranny which forces us to accept a specific point of view, a specific ideology, which is most dangerous. It's when we can't get any kind of imaginative hold on alternatives that we're indoctrinated. And really what public education does by virtue of leaving religion out is not give us any kind of hold on a religious understanding, which makes it conceivably an alternative way of understanding the world for students. Students simply don't understand what it is to see the world, understand it religiously.
Mm-hmm. Warren Nord directs the program in the humanities at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Ronald Sharp is a member of the Advisory Group on Primary and Secondary Education at the National Endowment for the Humanities. He teaches English at Kenyon College. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings is available on cassette. Ask for program number 425. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. That's program number 425. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Here's news of interest to high school teachers. In June and July of 1989, the National Humanities Center will sponsor seminars on two topics, literature and its audiences, and the concept of republicanism. These enrichment programs are for high school teachers of literature and history. For an application, write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. The deadline for applications is March 1st, 1989. Next week on Soundings, conversations with participants in the Center's 1988 summer seminars for high school teachers. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. The third week in November marks an anniversary for the American Bill of Rights, which was first ratified by the state of New Jersey in November 1789. During the third week of November 1963, President John F. Kennedy was killed in Dallas, Texas. Humankind's first free flight by balloon occurred in late November 1783 in Paris, France. Finally, the third week in November marks birthdays for the French philosopher Voltaire, born in 1694. For Henry McCarty, better known as the outlaw William H. Bonney or Billy the Kid, in 1859. For Scott Joplin, the American composer, born in 1868, and for Mary Ann Evans, the English novelist whose pen name was George Eliot, in 1819. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
This week on Soundings, scholars from the University of Rochester and North Carolina State University discuss foreign languages and literature in American education. What's popular, what's not, and how it's taught. Scholars from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and from Kenyon College talk about the perils and rewards of teaching religion in American schools. Foreign languages and religion in the schools. This week on Soundings.